So at the church cafe where I work, we're doing a questionnaire for people to fill out with the motivation that they get a free cup of coffee or tea if they do. So if I see you around in the next few weeks, I know why you're there. And one of the questions we've asked people is to circle what they think is most important. Justice or forgiveness? Justice or forgiveness? Which one is more important to you? I mention this because we finally come to the climax of the story, haven't we? Here's Joseph's story, and here he is. He's in front of his brothers. He's in a powerful position, and he's in front of his own brothers who have hated him and sold him into slavery. So what choice is Joseph going to choose? Is he going to choose forgiveness, or is he going to choose justice for the evil committed against him? I think most people today, I could be wrong, but I think most people today would choose justice. I hear far more people cry out for justice today than they do crying out for forgiveness. But I think that's partly because we don't see ourselves as the problem. We see ourselves as the victim. But what if we were the ones who had committed evil? What would we choose then? Would we choose forgiveness or justice? Well, as we think about this and as we cover these two and a bit chapters, I want you to have two big themes in mind. And the first theme that we'll be looking at is this, and it's really central not just to the Joseph story, but to the whole of the Bible, and it is this: God is a saving God. We're going to look at that, and then we're going to look at briefly a second main theme that runs out throughout the whole Bible as well, but here in Joseph's story, God is a promise-keeping God. And throughout both of them, we'll see how justice and forgiveness works. But before we do that, it really is crucial just to pick up on what Derek told us about this 20-year reunion between the brothers and Joseph last week. And one of the main things that we learned last week was, and it's crucial, that at the end of chapter 44, that the brothers had come to Joseph as changed brothers. That they were no longer hateful and murderous. They had turned their lives around from being jealous and angry to being kind and sacrificial. They were, as what Derek told us last week, they were repentant. And that is such a crucial thing to get hold of as we look at this story. And we have Judah, don't we, representing at the end of chapter 44, representing the attitude of his brothers when he's willing to take his brother's place, Benjamin's place, and say, I'm willing to sacrifice myself. And so, knowing the brothers that he knew 20 years ago, and now having the brothers that he's standing before him, these repentant brothers, is Joseph going to choose forgiveness, or is he going to choose justice? Well, let's dive in and see what happens, shall we? And first of all, you'll just see that the first thing that happens is that the tears cannot be held back. The tears cannot be held back. The emotional turmoil is just too much for Joseph, and he has a real big cry. My sister lives in Australia, so we don't get to see her that much, maybe every 2 years or so, and she's coming back this September. And when I see her, I think I'll be a little bit emotional. There might be a shedding of a tear. But imagine if the wait was 20 whole years and the things that have happened in those 20 whole years. And so weeping loudly, Joseph, he kicks out the Egyptians because he doesn't want them to hear what happens next. And finally, in verse 3, what do we read? He reveals himself to his brothers. He says, I am Joseph. And his brothers, well, we read in verse 3, his brothers are terrified. And they would be, right? Suddenly, the man they are dependent upon for food, for their lives, for their very survival, is the brother they beat and sold into slavery. The second most powerful man in the world, perhaps, is the brother they had betrayed. And they must have been wetting themselves. Because they knew that they were guilty. And so Joseph asked a second time, doesn't he, in verse 4, he has to say, I am your brother Joseph, you know, the one that you sold into slavery. Now, thankfully, Joseph just go on from that, but just stop there and just think, what must the brothers have thought when he mentioned that? They must have thought, oh crikey, he remembers. And of course he remembers, because we did something terrible to him. We committed a horrible, horrendous crime, and he's brought this up now because he's going to punish us, and he'd be right to punish us. And if that was the case, then we would have a completely different story. But thankfully, the next words that Joseph speaks are the most important words in the whole story of Joseph, perhaps. Because thankfully, Joseph reveals that our God is a saving God. Just look at me at verse 5. What does Joseph say next? "And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." And then in verse 7 he says, "But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." And just in case his brothers were a little bit unsure, in verse 8, "So then it is not you who sent me here, but God." What do we conclude from this? That God, in his sovereignty, is a saving God. Joseph says, "Yes, you sold me into slavery. Yes, you sinned against me, but God, he used your cruel actions in order to save you, to save you from this famine, to save you from death, and he put me right where I needed to be in order for you to find me, so that you could come to me, and so that I can tell you that God will save you through me." Isn't that amazing? I just think about that from the initial crime against Joseph in chapter 37 through the 20 years of highs and lows, Joseph knew that God was working in his life. And as we said time and time again, that God was using his suffering for good. And we see this, don't we? Because we see the end of Joseph's story. We see what it leads to. But often we don't have this perspective. We don't know the end of our story. We're stuck in the here and now, aren't we, where there's suffering and there's evil all around us or around the next turn. And what we have to remember is that, yes, God can deliver us out of this suffering, but more importantly, that God can use our suffering for good, either for the good of yourselves or for the good of someone else. You have to keep hold of the fact, we have to keep hold of the fact that God is powerful enough to use your suffering, and yet he is loving enough to know your deepest needs. And it takes trust to latch on to these two truths. And of course, it's easier said than done, me standing up here and saying that. But we've got the story of Joseph to take confidence in. And here in this story, we see the brothers coming to Joseph and Joseph forgiving his brothers. This is almost the turning point of the story, as the brothers are forgiven. And yeah, you might not read in the verses, you don't see that Joseph says outright, "I forgive you guys, don't worry about it." You don't read that, but you do see in his actions, and I think in his words, that it's clear that he does forgive them. Because what does he do? He tells them to go back, get his dad, and for them all to live in the land together. Indeed, I think there are actually two instances where there's quite a powerful symbolic portrait of forgiveness in this section. And the first is seen in verse 15. A little picture of forgiveness is seen in verse 15 when we read, "And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterwards, his brothers talked with him." Joseph kissed his brothers instead of punishing them. He kissed them on the face instead of punching them in the face. And you note that they talked with him? I think that is quite important, because back in Genesis 37 and verse 4, it says the brothers hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And now we have here the wonderful fact that they are talking and weeping in love. What a powerful picture of forgiveness that is. But I don't think that is the most powerful picture, because if you go to verse 22, you see something else. You see Joseph giving his brothers what? New clothing. Now, where in your mind does that take your head back into the Joseph story? Well, remember that this whole division and hate started because of a certain item of new clothing worn by Joseph, what's been labeled as the coat of many colors. It's as if we're meant to see here that the things that caused separation are now forgiven and forgotten, and in place we have reconciliation, mending of a broken relationship. So Joseph, he doesn't just forgive them of their crimes. That's one thing. He's seeking reconciliation with them. He's seeking to bring them back, for them to have peace with him and to bring them back into a family relationship that is close and personal. He, through God, will deliver them from famine and death to have life with him. And if that sounds like good news, if that sounds like amazing news, if that sounds familiar, that's because that is really just a picture of the gospel. This is the gospel, the good news of Jesus. You see, just like the brothers, and by the way, as Derek reminded us last week, we are the brothers in this story. Blimey, we're the brothers. We're not Joseph, even though we want to be Joseph. We think we don't need to be saved. We think we're in control of our lives. We are the brothers in this story. And therefore, we need saving. We need rescuing. We need forgiveness. Why do we need forgiveness? A few years ago, some psychologists got together and decided to do a study on forgiveness. And after their study, they actually concluded that, yeah, forgiveness is actually a really good thing. And they concluded, forgiveness allows you to let go of the chronic interpersonal stresses that causes undue burden. It helps with depression and anxiety and physical health systems. And yeah, that might be true, but let me tell you, that is not the reason why we need forgiveness. We need forgiveness because our problem isn't psychological. It isn't physical. Our problem is ultimately spiritual. There is a bigger burden that needs lifting. You see, just like the brothers without a rescuer, we are caught by the spiritual famine of sin. Starved of knowing God, which ultimately leads to death. Yes, physical death, but also spiritual death as God judges us for our rebellion and our sin. Which means, just like the brothers, we need rescuing, we need saving, we need forgiving. And who comes as the rescuer? Who comes as the savior? Who comes to forgive? It's Jesus. You see, this story tells us that God does save, that our God is a God who saves. And he can deliver us from famine, and he can deliver us from death, and he can forgive us. He can reconcile us. He can mend that broken relationship between us. He can bring peace where once there was conflict. He can bring a relationship where once there was anger or indifference, which means that there doesn't have to be any more loneliness. Because being reconciled to God makes us a part of his family and a community. And it also means that we don't have to be in control of our lives because we have a God who ultimately is. And it also means you don't have to strive for and look for that perfect relationship, that soulmate. When we have in God that perfect relationship, a love relationship that lasts forever. And isn't that what we're looking for, deep down? And it is found in God. But see, please see the urgency of this story. Without Joseph, the brothers will die. There's 5 more years of famine. They haven't got a chance on their own. They have no hope of saving themselves. I've recently been watching a TV series that centers on the survival of the human race. You know these post-apocalyptic dramas that seem to be quite popular these days? And as I was watching it, the amount of times I heard the characters say something like this. It's up to us to save ourselves. We're the only ones that can save ourselves. We can save humanity. And you know what? This problem, this idea is something that we believe, that we drink in. Only we don't see ourselves as the problem, but the world around us is the problem that needs fixing. Our modern culture has decided that it's the things outside that need changing, not the things that are inside of us. The things that are inside of us, our feelings are good. It's the things that are outside of us that are the problem. So what we need to do is, in order to really be who we are and meant to be, we can leave our house and leave our partner and leave our church and change our appearance and change our environment. We can change everything apart from what's inside of us. That's what our culture is telling us. And you could read this story and say, yeah, that's correct, because the brothers, they leave Canaan, don't they? And they come to a different place. But if you read it like that, you're forgetting once again that the brothers came at the beginning of chapter 45 as repentant brothers. And that is the reason why Joseph could save. That is the reason why Joseph could forgive. You see, the problem is, that we're the problem. That we've chosen self-rule over God's rule. And ultimately, all the fixes that we try and implement, some of them might be good, but eventually all the fixes that we try and implement, they won't save us. And that's because when you've got it, when you're sick, you go see a doctor, right? Generally, that's a good idea. When you're sick, you go see a doctor. Maybe not one in Greece, but you go see a doctor. And because we're rebels rebelling against God, we need to go see Jesus. And realize we are completely dependent upon Jesus for forgiveness and for deliverance and for eternal life. And that's what Jesus is offering. Just like Joseph, he is offering life, not death. And a personal, close relationship with him. A family relationship. Is this something you want this morning? Do you want forgiveness? Do you want a close family relationship with Jesus? Maybe you're here this morning, I don't know, maybe you're here this morning and you think you just can't be forgiven. Your sin is just too great. Well, Joseph's own brothers sold him into slavery, then lied about it to their dad and said that he died, and yet they were forgiven. So if they can be forgiven, so can you, because there's no sin too great that cannot be forgiven. And do you want to know why? I asked that question right at the beginning, what was more important, justice or forgiveness? What would Joseph choose, justice or forgiveness? And the brighter folk among you will probably think, well, it's a bit of a trick question, that, isn't it, Mark? You want to know why Joseph can forgive his brothers? It's because Jesus died on the cross for their sins. And for our sins, so that we can be rescued, we can be saved, we can be forgiven. Justice was done on the cross. Jesus took our sins, our rebellion on the cross so that we can be forgiven. So in a sense, justice has to come first. Justice was done on the cross so you can be forgiven. Isn't that amazing? That is wonderful news. And all we have to do is we have to come to Jesus and simply ask for forgiveness and trust in him as our Savior and Lord. Because do you notice that? There's some really powerful words that Joseph brings right at the beginning of this chapter. What does Joseph say to his brothers in verse 4? Come close to me. And again in verse 9, come down to me, don't delay. Come close to me, come down to me, don't delay. You see, that's the invitation of the gospel. That's the invitation that Jesus gives. He says, come close to me. Come down to me. Don't delay. He says to his disciples, doesn't he? Come, follow me. And he says famously in Matthew 11, 28, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Come to me, all you who are burdened by your sin and your rebellion, and I will give you rest. I will give you salvation. I will give you forgiveness. I will give you life. So have you come to Jesus yet? Asking for forgiveness. You see, the brothers, knowing this forgiveness, knowing this that they were reconciled, that their broken relationship had been mended, and probably spurred on by the grace that they've been received as well. I mean, Joseph, he says, I'll provide everything that you need. And then Pharaoh, via Joseph, says, you can have the best of the land. So they weren't just pardoned, they were looked after. And so spurred on by this forgiveness and this good news, what do? Well, they obey Joseph and they go back and get their dad and tell him the greatest news that he could ever hear. That Joseph is alive. It's great when we've got good news to tell, isn't it? The good news that I've got a new job, or I'm engaged, or I'm moving house, and we can't wait, can we, when we've got this good news to tell people. And here the brothers traveling back to their father, tell Jacob the good news that Joseph is alive. And because Joseph is alive, they will be rescued from death and starvation, and they can live with him. That is the attitude that we should have. We should have this attitude where we can go to people with the good news, not that Joseph is alive, but that Jesus is alive. And because Jesus is alive, we've got a ministry, a message of reconciliation, as Paul said, as Derek read at the beginning of our service. And because we've got this good news, we should have this attitude where we want to tell people that Jesus is alive. But the problem is, it's a problem that I have. I tend to speak about myself more. I tend to talk about other things a lot. And yes, you've got to talk about other things. It can't just be Jesus all the time. But often, I don't have this attitude where the good news of Jesus, that he is alive and that you can have forgiveness, is there on my tongue when the opportunity comes. Help this to be the case. Make this to be the case in your lives. Have this good news and declare to people that the rescue is on. We love a good rescue story, don't we? And I don't think you could get much more dramatic of a rescue story than what happened in July in Thailand. You know, when the 12 boys and their football coach were trapped in the caves for days before they were even found, and then even when they were found, it took days for them to be rescued. And what was very clear in that was that they had absolutely no chance of saving themselves. They needed people to come and save them. It even took one of the divers' lives for them to be saved. And it was good news on the news for once, which was great. And everybody was talking about it. And here the brothers, they have good news that they are telling to their dad, which is pointing to the greater news of the greatest rescue of all time. That Jesus saves. That our God is a saving God. If you forget anything else this morning, latch onto that. Our God is a saving God. But also, as we look down onto this story from chapter 46 onwards, we'll also see that our God is a promise-keeping God. Let's face it, we live in a world, don't we, beset with broken promises. The world offers so much and often fails to deliver. Promises that lead to relationship breakdown, heartache, despair, holidays that offer paradise but end up being a nightmare. And so why is it that we can trust God's promises when the world constantly lets us down? Why can we trust God's promises? Well, we can do this by really zooming out a little bit and seeing the bigger picture here of the Joseph story. And what we have to do is we have to imagine what the original listeners of Genesis, hearing this story for the first time, must have thought. What you might not know is that Genesis was written by Moses at a time when the Israelites had left Egypt after 400 years of slavery, and they'd crossed the Red Sea in dramatic fashion, and they'd seen all the wonderful miracles by God, and yet in the wilderness, some were still not convinced, some were still grumbling, and some were even saying, it'd be better to live in Egypt than here. At this point, the original listeners of Genesis were not trusting in God's promises. And so we have at the beginning of chapter 46, what do we have? We have Jacob taking all his family and his possessions and leaving for Egypt, don't we? But just like the Israelites who were afraid after leaving Egypt, their father Jacob was afraid to enter Egypt. And so God, for the last time until he appears to Moses, appears to Jacob in a dream at Beersheba, at the southern tip of Canaan. And after Canaan, there's desert, and then Egypt. And this place is a place where his father visited and his grandfather visited, and afraid and anxious, perhaps because he's very old, I don't know if you noticed, but he was quite old in the Bible reading. But perhaps also because when there was a famine in his father's time, his father was told not to go down into Egypt. And so in a dream, God comes to him with these wonderful words in verse 3. Just note these wonderful promises by God. Verse 3 of chapter 46, "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes. Do you see the promises of God here? Now, the original hearers, after leaving Egypt and fleeing dramatically the Red Sea, they hear the words, don't they? I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And we'll realize that God was with them all along, and God promised that he would take them out of Egypt. This was God's plan. And if God promises something, then his promise will be fulfilled. But we read also the promise to Jacob, I will make you into a great nation there. Now, if you know Genesis at all, then that's the promise that God gave to Abraham back in Genesis 12. But God also gave Abraham another promise in Genesis 15, verse 13. He said this, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and ill-treated there. So God promises on the one hand that he will make his descendants into a great nation, yet on the other hand he's saying, yeah, but they're going to be enslaved for 400 years. So how does God keep both of these promises? By sending Jacob down into Egypt, and by saying it is there that the nation will be born. And as if to convince those original hearers who were just a little bit unsure that this was all part of God's plan, we have this genealogy that we skipped in our reading in verses 8 to 27. This is the genealogy of the original 12. It's the founding fathers, as it were. And really, it's showing the original listeners that these 12 brothers, these famous names who would become tribes, if they went down into Egypt, then that was where God wanted them to be. And if God said, I will take you down into Egypt and I will surely bring you back again, then God's promises must be true. God keeps his promises and makes a great nation. And if you're not convinced, then just if you like this kind of thing, just compare the genealogy here with the genealogy in Numbers 26, and you'll see that now Israel numbered in their thousands. Had a great nation been born in Egypt in slavery? Yes. Because God's promises are more certain than the sun shining in the desert. Do you trust them? And we have that wonderful promise that God gives to Jacob, don't we? That he'll see his son again, his long-lost son. And so in verse 29, we get a happy reunion. And don't we love happy reunions? At long last, the son that had been cast out of his father's lands and was unjustly removed from his father's presence is back with the father. The family is complete again, and they all have a good cry, don't they? Because if you haven't realized yet, Joseph was a crier in this story. But more importantly, because God keeps his promises, he said to the old elderly Jacob that he would see his son again. And he did. As one writer says, summing up all this, he says, God's promises are true and truly kept. God's promises are true and truly kept. And so we have then the final couple of scenes, don't we? Where Joseph's brothers meet Pharaoh, and then finally Jacob meets Pharaoh. And we don't have time to really look into this, but I want you just to notice one thing. And in order to do that, just flick back to verse 10 of chapter 45. Because in verse 10 of chapter 45, we read that Joseph has been pushing right from here that for them all to live in a region called Goshen or Goshen, however you pronounce it. And so then at the end of chapter 46, and then into 47, he's instructing his brothers to admit to Pharaoh that they are shepherds. Why? Because it seems like the Egyptians frown upon, and that's putting it lightly, frown upon nomadic shepherd type people. And so Joseph, knowing the Egyptians, knows that what will happen then is that they will be separate from the true Egyptian blood. And so he's pushing for this land of Goshen. And where is this? Well, probably on the eastern delta of the Nile. Now, for you guys and for me who have no idea of geography, why is that significant? Because it's on the edge of the kingdom. It's the perfect place for a quick getaway. Or as one writer says, it's the perfect place for an exodus, isn't it? You see, even here, God is planning their escape. Because what does God say? He says, I will surely bring you back again. And when God says, I will surely do something, you can be sure that he will. And so listen up, you people who have fled Egypt and have fled through the Red Sea. God keeps his promises. He brought Israel the man in, and he led Israel the nation out. Yes, it took 400 years for God to keep his promises, but that's because God's plans are on his timetable, not ours. I love Amazon Prime. You know why I love Amazon Prime? Not because of the way that they treat their workers, but because when I order something, I know that it's going to be delivered in speedy fashion. And I love Google Calendar. Why? Because I can plan my week, my month, my year out in advance. But the problem is, God doesn't fit into our schedule. And we have to realize this, that we need to be able to fit into God's timetable, God's schedule. And that takes patience. And for that to happen, we need to look beyond ourselves, knowing that this world, this famine, this Egypt that we live in isn't our home. See, just like Joseph and his family, we are foreigners living in a foreign land. But here's something else we have to understand. The whole trajectory of the first five books of the Bible is leading from, as one writer says, from paradise to the promised land. And you get a hint of that in the promise that God gave to Jacob. I will surely bring you back again. Back again to where? Well, where was he saying that promise? He was saying it at Beersheba in Canaan, at the southern tip of what will be the promised land. Egypt is not the final destination for God's people. And likewise, although Spen Valley is the place that where we serve and we've got lots of work to do here, we need to realize that this isn't the final place for God's people. We have to look towards, in a sense, the promised land that God promises us. We have to look heavenward, always having that perspective that this isn't the end, that we've got something to look forward to. And we can be sure of this because as the first song that we sang said, and as Paul writes, we are children of the promise. The promise that God gave to Abraham and was kept through Jacob. And as a direct result of Israel going into Egypt and Israel exiting Egypt, God was working a saving plan that was ultimately fulfilled in Jesus. And we can be sure of this because he just again, just note back in verse 7 of chapter 45 as we come to our close. Because there's a hint right here that this is the case when Joseph says to his brothers, but God sent me ahead of you to reserve for you a remnant on earth. And if you know your Old Testament, that this idea of a remnant, of a group of people that will always be faithful to God is a big theme in the Old Testament. And really, this is where we need to see the bigger picture. That Joseph's story is a small part of God's bigger story, of God's rescue story. Where as he leads Egypt out, Israel out of Egypt, and they will live for 40 years in the wilderness. They will eventually go into the promised land. And then from the promised land, judges will rise up and deliver them again and again because they are rebellious. And then kings will come and rule over them. And a temple will be built. But the people are constantly rebelling. And so the kingdom divides. And rebellion really is the watchword of Israel. And so prophets come and warn them of this rebellion and try and point them back towards the promises of God. And yet, constantly Israel are rebelling. And so exile ensues. And eventually Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. And yet always, throughout this tragic history of Israel, God is keeping his promises because there are always a faithful remnant, a faithful people that are looking towards God's promises. for God's promises to be fulfilled. And ultimately, we can see that God's promises are fulfilled 2,000 years ago, when in the fullness of time, Jesus came and lived and died and rose from the grave. He is the fulfillment of God's saving promises. So whose promises are you going to trust? As you walk out of this building, are you going to trust the promises of the world that flatter to deceive, that so often fade and fall and break? Or will you put your trust in the promises of God, who put in motion a rescue plan even back in Genesis? A rescue plan that led to Jesus and the cross, to a God who forgives, to a God who reconciles, to a God who is a saving God, and to a God who is a promise-keeping God, to a God who promises, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest."